memories put down by Anne Vera McKee in request from Margaret Pilkington of Casterton, Cumbria. I was born in Southampton on Primrose Day 1903. Primrose Day is April 19th. I was born into a family of five boys and five girls. Our father was a general practitioner in the town. Four of the boys followed his profession, and one daughter was a pharmacist. I myself had at one time hoped to do medicine, but was told that the boys must finish first. And so I switched to teaching, and actually have been very happy in that profession. I was educated in the town. For college, I went to University College of Southampton. At that time, it did not give degrees, and therefore we had to go up to London and take the University of London degrees. And in order to avoid paying tuition fees, or very small ones, I forget which, I took the Board of Education teacher training, which was 2 years, and did the degree work at the same time. My degree was a BSc general degree, which was thought better for teaching purposes. My first job was in Cornwall at Truro Technical School. This was an experimental kind of school. The children came from all over the county by train every day, and the boys did metalwork and woodwork and so on, and the girls did shorthand typing. I spent four very happy years there, and then moved up to Derbyshire to Matlock and taught in the Ernest Bailey School. About that time, I had written to the London Missionary Society saying that I was free to go abroad and asking if they had a job in a mission school they would like me to do. And so, when they had accepted me, they said they needed a secondary school teacher in Shanghai, and that is where I went. I went to Mary Farnham School. It was had been started by an American society on about the turn of the century. At that time, one of the stipulations was that no girl might come who had had her feet bound, which shows the period. The reason I taught in an American-run school was because at that time the London Missionary Society had only a boys' secondary school and a primary school. And it was in order that our girls may all go over together that we arranged with the American Presbyterian Mission that we would send our girls to Mary Farnham School and supply a member of staff. Mary Farnham School and the boys' school run by the Americans was in Nantou, which means the south area. It was in the native city. There wasn't much left of the old walls, but you could really tell when you were out of the international settlement and into the native city. I went out to teach science and religious education. A year or two after I'd started, a directive came down from the government to say that all subjects other than English must be taught in Chinese. This made it a bit difficult for me. Of course, we had a Chinese textbook, which was a translation of an English one, but the written examination papers were apt to be a bit illegible as the girls wrote in a hurry, and I had to say to them that if they wrote too roughly, I would have to call their answer wrong. At any rate, a little later we were able to get a Chinese girl graduate, and she took over from me, and I switched to maths and English, because of course a native speaker was able to help with conversation. As for religious education, any girls who were interested could join discussion groups, and on Sundays we went to the local church. This was a church of the Church in Christ in China, a unity. In the summertime, we wanted to give the girls opportunity to put their Christianity into practice. And so they organized and ran a summer school for some of the children on the streets outside who had no chance of getting an education. The girls in Mary Farnham School were very much like girls anywhere, but they did perhaps take more interest in their government and what the government did. At that time, General Chiang Kai-shek was the ruler of the country. Perhaps he was more popular in the West than in his own country, because when in 1937 the Japanese dropped bombs on Shanghai, he seemed to be hesitant about tackling the problem of fighting the Japanese. The reason, of course, he was far more fearful of the rise of communism in his own country. But the girls, along with the students in other schools, felt that he ought to face up to the Japanese. They all went on strike and marched up to the station and demanded transport to Nanking in order to put their views to the government. Transport was refused, and they then lay down in the tracks for the day. But of course, their protest didn't seem to make very much impression. I forgot to say that in 1937, when there was bombing, which incidentally I heard when I was on leave in England, I just heard bombs have been dropped on Nantou. And of course I was a bit worried. At any rate, our school was damaged and we had to transfer to a house in the international settlement and run a school there in two parts, a morning class and an afternoon class. We had to find accommodation in the international settlement, and I shared a flat with Janet Tomkinson, who was then Nettie Vane. In 1939, it became obvious that trouble was ahead, and we wondered about helping the Christian girls in their discussion groups to meet together, and we formed groups based on their geographical homes. And as a matter of fact, those proved very helpful when to meet in Christian groups was not allowed later on. In 1939, war was declared in Europe. It didn't affect us very much until Pearl Harbor, which was in December 1941. Then, of course, we were enemy nationals to the Japanese, and they overran Shanghai and took control there. Anybody who was British or American had to wear an armband with a B or an A on it, and no more than three armband wearers were allowed to meet together on the street. In early 1942, they decided they would intern us. And so they set up a number of camps around Shanghai. One camp had the families with children so that a school could be run for them. I was sent to a camp which was actually upcountry in the ancient city of Yangzhou, where we were housed in a boarding school. At the time, the country people round were very loath to sell grain to the Japanese, and they had a bit of a problem feeding us. But a bit later, arrangements were made for an exchange of prisoners of war, and the Japanese in America were exchanged with Americans interned in Shanghai. This left many empty places in the Shanghai camps, and we were brought down from Yangzhou to fill up these places. We traveled in little boats down the Grand Canal to Shanghai, and we tied up at a wharf, and in front of us was a great building, a warehouse belonging to the war. This had been an internment camp for men only, and some of them had vowed they wouldn't shave until they were released. Consequently, when we arrived, we looked at this building, and at every window was a hairy, bearded face. We wondered rather where we had been brought. At any rate, in quite a short time, as you may imagine, the beards disappeared. We were about 1,000 people in the camp, and we were really left to organize ourselves as to who did the cooking, the cleaning, and so on. Missionary doctors and nurses were asked to run a hospital of sorts and to run a school for the few children we had. I think it was about 20 or 30. This was my job, naturally. It was a little difficult with textbooks because the children came from different schools, and even if the parents were thoughtful enough to bring textbooks, they were all different. Anyway, we did run the school, and it had to be in one of the great big rooms which you find in a warehouse. This was the living room, and you would find in one corner of it a man doing eye exercises with people, or physical exercises. In another corner were women sewing, trying to make clothes. The children who grew out of anything that was given to them. And our school was in another corner, and I must say the children learned in a wonderful way how to concentrate. All sorts of things went on in the camp. We had lectures from specialists in different subjects, we had concerts, because there had been an American ship liner port in Shanghai, and we inherited the downspan. And in the camp we had a very musical chap, and he whipped the downspan into shape, playing classical music, and we really had some very good concerts. I remember at one time he composed a piece of music into which he wove the lines of the national anthem, the British national anthem. When he played this one night, there were loud cheers from everyone. And our guards, who liked to attend these concerts, were quite mystified as to why we liked that particular piece of music. We were in camp until 1945, VJ Day, August. And then most of us were waiting for transport back to England. We had gone back, I had gone back to the school and was continuing teaching there. And I was telephoned to one morning, and somebody said that there is transport for 20 on a small naval vessel here. They will take you down to Hong Kong. Could you be ready tomorrow morning? And I said, of course I can. And we went down to Hong Kong on this little naval vessel, sleeping in hammocks in the dining room. And then the authorities persuaded the vessel to take us on to Colombo, and there we waited until a liner came up from Australia on its way to England, and we joined the many refugees, as it were, there. After a very happy leave, getting acquainted with new members of the family and so on, and doing a certain amount of deputation, I went back to Shanghai and found that the school had been able to go back into Nantou. That must have been early 46. The next disturbing event was, of course, in 49, when the communists took control in Shanghai. A new head was appointed, the firm Communists, and our head, who incidentally had been in Hong Kong on holiday when the Communists took over, but had determined that her place was with the school, with her school, and she came back, much to the surprise of other people who felt she should have taken a chance to escape communist rule. But Beulah Chang, as her name was a very fine character. The staff of the school were expected to study communism. They were divided up into small groups for this purpose. My group discussed, well, we were given the subjects to discuss, things like hell, and I piped up and told them about the British National Health Scheme. But the communists seemed to have an idea of England that was somewhat Dickensian. And it meant that rather prolonged discussion, and I having to give all sorts of examples, so that the members of my group came and said, "We know what you say is true, and the communists hadn't got the right idea of England, but will you not talk about it so that our classes, our discussion groups can be shorter?" So I had to shut up. A little bit later, a directive came to say that no foreign funds would enter China. And this meant, of course, nothing came from the LMS or American Presbyterians. But Miss Chang, our own head, she organized the school under the communist head, said that she would arrange that we should be kept as far as food and lodging was concerned if we were only willing to stay. So of course we said that we would stay. But a bit later, when the discussion groups had to march on the street waving flags and saying, "Down with the Americans," she and we decided that perhaps we were becoming a bit of an encumbrance. And so we laid plans to leave as soon as we could get an exit visa. During those final days, waiting for our visa, we gave away all that we could from our house to Chinese friends. I got my visa fairly easily, but Grace Darling, which was the name of the American foreign teacher in the school, didn't get hers. Mine gave me 3 months to leave, and during that time I was hoping, praying that she would get her visa so that we could go out together and I wouldn't have to leave her by herself. On the very last Saturday, before I had to leave on the Monday, Grace got her visa, and there was a hectic running round to all the offices who had to stamp this visa. But everything was ready, and on the Monday morning we had a lovely committal service I mean, the Christian pastor came over and we all committed each other to the care of God, and we set off by train for Hong Kong. I must say it was rather a joy as we crossed the bridge into Hong Kong from China to see the Union Jack flying over us. The year was now 1951, 2 years after the communists had arrived. I went on leave, and the mission house asked me where I would like to go. And I said, well, anywhere but Hong Kong, feeling that it would be tantalizing to be so near China and not of it. But after a little while, the mission said that they would like me to go to Hong Kong, and so to Hong Kong I went. I went to the Yinghua Girls' School. There was a Yinghua Boys' School in the Kowloon area, and the girls' school was on the island of Hong Kong. Unfortunately, it meant learning a new dialect, Cantonese. And evidently, I never lost the touch of the Shanghai dialect in my Cantonese, because often, after I'd been talking a while to a Chinese friend, I would be asked, when did you come out of Shanghai? And I taught in Hong Kong until 1961, which meant that I had completed 30 years teaching abroad, and then I retired and came back to England. I found that before I could qualify for any recognition of my years of teaching in England, before I went abroad, I would have to complete 10 years and teach 3 more years. And so I did. I taught first in a boarding school in Dorset for a term, just to get used to English education. And then I went to the Glen Eyre Secondary School. And I taught there, and then later taught part-time at a small school in Southampton. And so I completed my teaching experience. Except that wherever I've been, I've always found perhaps Chinese people living in England who wanted help with their English, and that I continue to do in adult education classes, which was very nice. I found quite a difference in the attitude of the girls do their schooling from the attitude of Chinese girls. Chinese girls have to compete for places, and they know that if they don't keep up the standard, they will have to give way to someone else. Whereas it seemed to me that the girls in our secondary mod school were just waiting for the day they could leave school. I remember one time before the school leaving age was raised to 16, being asked by one girl, "Is it true, miss, that they're going to make us stay at school till we're 16? And I said, "Yes, it looks like it." And she said, "Well, do they expect us to come pushing prams, miss?" Now, you've had a rough outline of my rather uninteresting life, and not that it was uninteresting to me. I've been very lucky in all my experiences and in my work. I see there's a bit of tape left, but I don't know what particular part of it I should enlarge upon. That's your fault, Margaret. If you want to ask me questions, you'll have to do just that.